everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone here. My name is Marcy, and I am an alcoholic. You know, I was kind of chuckling there for a moment. As I walked up on the stage, I noticed something. And what I noticed was I went to the bathroom back there, and that faucet kind of squirts on me, and I had water all over the front of my pants. And I said to myself, I sure hope they have a podium here because you're going to think I peed in my pants. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that hasn't had to happen in a lot of years. My sobriety date is March 15th of 1988. And this is something that I certainly didn't do alone. If you weren't here, it wouldn't have happened. So I give Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that credit, because I didn't know anything when I came in here. And my sponsor will probably say I still don't know anything, but that's on you. Anyway, I'd like to tell you a little bit about, you know, what it was like, what happened then, what it's like today. And, you know, I'd also like to say that, you know, when I was a newcomer, and I know we have a lot of people here who are new in the fellowship, and I just encourage you to bear with me on this, but I know, speaking for myself, you know, when I first came into the fellowship, I had all of these horrific problems, and they were horrific problems. You know, my life just didn't seem like it had any balance to it. It didn't seem like it had any purpose to it. It was all bad. That's the way I perceived it. And I would go to meetings, and it might be a topic meeting, it might be a closed meeting, whatever it might be. And oftentimes, there would be people talking about things that I did not relate to. And unfortunately for me, oftentimes I would get up and I'd walk out of that meeting and I'd go to another meeting or someplace else, you know, because I wasn't hearing what I thought I needed to hear. And that's where I was in the beginning. But there was a gentleman, and I used his last name simply because I have his permission to use his last name, you know, long before he passed away, and it was Jim Luber from Porterville. And what Jim used to tell me, he says, Marcy, he says, I am so grateful that you have a stick-to-itiveness. And to this day, I don't know if that's a real word or not. But Jim used to come up with those kind of words every once in a while. But he always had me, and always said to me, he said, you just keep coming back, you're doing fine. And he always tapped me on the shoulder. And I always appreciated that, you know, forever being my prayers. And it was all about just keep coming back. And, you know, we hear those expressions, you know, just wait till the miracle happens, you know. And I think we each and every one of us has a part in making that miracle happen. We have to do our part. You know, for some of us, we come in here because of our wives. Some of us come in because of the judge. And then some of us come in because we're ready to come in, you know. But however you're here, if you're here with a court card, if you're here because your wife says, I'm out of here unless you do something about your drinking, whatever reason you're here, if you have a desire to stop drinking, I encourage you to just keep coming back. And you can look up that word, stick-to-itiveness, because as I said, I don't know if it's real or not, but it works. So keep coming back. I'd like to tell you a little bit about, you know, the way it was. And, you know, I can't blame my father. I can't blame my brothers, my sisters, or anybody else. You know, it's just the way it was. You know, I grew up a scared little boy. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous many years later, I was still a scared little boy. But I want to tell you just a little bit about that scared little boy a long time ago. I had a wonderful family. I'm the youngest of nine children. My father had the disease of alcoholism. My mother did the very best she could, and I'm sure my father did the very best he could with what he knew. And we had our good times and our bad times, you know, in our family. But, you know, on occasions when I have the opportunity to share like this, you know, I used to feel real bad about talking about some of the things that happened to me as a child, you know, the way it was. And I felt real bad about that. And, you know, before my father passed away, he was you know, I asked him, I said, Daddy, I said, you know, I said, some of the things that happened, I said, do you mind if I talk about those? And he just said, it's all about, you know, if it helps you, and you go ahead and do that. I will tell you that my father died with 32 years of continued sobriety. I love my father more than anybody in this world. And that makes it kind of hard to tell how it was. But, you know, some of those little things that I can't remember, like if you were to ask me to come up in front of a group of people when I was in the fifth grade, sixth grade, or whatever it was, and ask me to share in front of a group of people, I would probably pee in my pants, and I would probably just pray that the floor opened up and I would just fall through, because that's the way it was when I was a little boy. You know, I was raised in this family where we had this big elephant in the living room, and the elephant in the living room was my father and my father's alcoholism. And we tiptoed around that elephant in the living room. We didn't talk about that. And I was raised, and my mother thought that, you know, how we were seen from the outside, you know, was going to determine, you know, how people really felt about us. So I was raised, Mama would always say to me, Marcy, be nice. Make everybody like you. Always be nice and make everybody like you. And we came out from Oklahoma, and we lived in labor camps, and we followed the fruit for many, many years until we settled in Strathmore. And as a child, being the youngest, I have a shirt in my closet that my daughter-in-law made me, and that shirt says, Mama loves me best. And I don't know if that's true or not. I'm sure she loved us all equally. But my mom, she did a lot of things for me. Got me out of a lot of scrapes when I was little. And, you know, there were times when I was growing up as a child, because of my father's alcoholism and the way our family was, when I would get out of school to ride the school bus, I never knew whether I was supposed to get on the school bus or one of my older brothers and sisters was going to be there to pick me up and take me home. And I really never knew where home was going to be, because oftentimes the rent did not get paid and we would be evicted. And so I had a lot of insecurities, you know, as a child growing up. A lot of fears and a lot of insecurities. And going to school, I always hated it. I was going to this little place called Strathmore Elementary School. And I was just thinking about that the other day. I can remember what my first grade school teacher smelled like. I can remember this first grade school teacher. I think she only had one dress. She wore it just every day. It was a plaid red and gray dress. And back in those days, if you fell out on the little football field or playground, you know, the teachers could pick you up and, you know, put you in their bosom and say, oh, you poor baby, everything's going to be okay. And I don't know why I was thinking about that, but most of my... Later on in years, I learned to appreciate that. But, you know, I have to kind of chuckle about something. It's we go to a lot of meetings and a lot of speakers, and if you listen very closely on most speakers' tapes, there's a few ladies at this table right here. You'll always hear that same chuckle on all those tapes. But at any rate, you know, going to that school, one of the things that that I remember was I always used to hate it when the teachers would say something like, well, tomorrow we're going to have our hearing check and our height and our weight and all that kind of stuff, and it scared me to death. Because I knew they were going to find something wrong with me. You know, I knew something was going to be wrong with my ears or my eyes or something was going to happen. And we had to take off our shoes when we got weighed. And I got one pair of shoes a year, and they were tennis shoes from a place called Kirby's in Porterville. And I can remember having to take off my shoes, and I would always pretend like I had a stomachache before we went up to get weighed. And the reason for that is because my socks always had big holes in them. And so I would sneak back to the back of the classroom, and I would take some straight pins off of the bulletin board back there, and I would sneak out to the bathroom, and I would take my socks, and I would pull them out, pull them down over my toes, pull the sock underneath, and tape them so that my socks looked as new as anybody else's. And so I was looking around at these art projects here today, and when I was in the fifth grade, we had a little art contest. And I had a particular person who thought he was all that. And I had an older sibling, and she was a very good artist. So I asked her if she would go to the cartoons in the funny papers and draw me a picture for this art contest, and I would pretend it was mine. And she did. She drew this beautiful picture and everything, and it was really nice. I took it to school, and this one person that I hated until the day that I got sober. And started working the steps, okay? At any rate, he called me on it. He said, "You didn't do that. You're not that good." Uh-huh. Yes, I am. And I tried to convince him that I did that picture. Tried to convince everybody. And, you know, finally I got so angry because they didn't believe me that I just tore it up and threw it in the trash. You know. And that, when I was looking at these pictures right here, I kind of remembered that. And I'll bet you I hadn't thought of that in 30 years. But I just did. God kind of works in mysterious ways. But at any rate, when I grew up, was growing up, you know, it was all about a lot of uncomfortable things happening in my life, as happens to a lot of us. And the deal was, I didn't have any coping skills. I wasn't taught coping skills. My parents probably didn't know how to teach us coping skills. But it was all about be nice and make everybody like you, and people taking advantage of me all the way through my adolescence. But you know, the way I look at it, and this is just the way I look at it, and I'm not going to say this is my opinion, because I got into trouble here last weekend when I used that word, and when I started saying my opinion. I had a very difficult situation, which I won't go into, but the way I see it, okay, I'll write that a little better. The way I see it, and is, you know, life was life, you know, until I got in high school, and when I was introduced to alcohol when I was in high school. My sister had a garage party, my older sister at her house, and one of her boyfriends, 60, some Seagram 7 and 7-Up. And I can remember drinking that Seagram 7 and 7-Up, and I can remember what it did to me. And from that day on, I knew that there was a solution to those perceived problems that I had. I didn't feel as inadequate. I didn't feel as less than. My chest on occasions could get kind of bowed out. And I had that false sense of security that I developed until I got into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at any rate, I used and abused alcohol through high school, but I was very clever, unlike some of you people. But I was very, very clever. Nobody ever knew that I was drinking. Nobody ever knew I was drinking, right? But I got into a lot of situations and a lot of problems in my life. And the thing of it was is, with a face like this, you can get off with a lot of good stuff. You know, people just like, oh, Marcy, he, you know. I can remember going to a judge. I remember going to a judge in Lindsay at the time, and it was for all of my alcohol-related issues. And he would say things like, well, Marcy, can't you just wait till you get home before you drink? And not drink and drive anymore. Can you? Oh, yeah, sure, I can do that. You know. And then I would go to the doctor. You know, I would develop these things like I had a couple of hernias and an appendectomy and stuff. And I can remember sitting there in that hospital bed ready to go in for surgery. And my doctor would come up to me and he said, and just how much do you drink or do you drink? And I said, well, I have a couple of beers, you know, now and then. And just a couple of, you know, and I minimized everything that I did. But at any rate, you know, alcohol turned on me somewhere along the line. But I drank alcoholically from the day that I started drinking. Rarely did I get drunk. I drank all the time, and I stayed on this particular level that I needed to be on. I would wake up in the morning, and I would have two great big old tall glasses of Carl Rossi Burgundy, the one that cost $2.39 a gallon. And somebody told me that it cost about $8 now. I don't know. Inflation. But at any rate, you know, the thing of it was, you know, I don't want to go into a whole lot of the way, you know, the way it was, what happened. But at any rate, there came a time when alcohol churned on me, and I think, you know, I'm just going to tell this one little story that I think Annette asked me to tell, and I'm going to tell it anyway. I call it one of my naked stories. And so you might want to put your hands over your ears or something like that, okay? But we had this lake up in Porterville, and it was called, what is it, Success or something up there? Success Lake. And I had on some shorts, and I had on some shoes, and I had on a backpack, and it was in October. And the water was very, very low, and I was going out, and I was looking for plugs to, you know, fishing plugs and all that kind of stuff. And I had parked my car on one side of the lake and was walking clear across the other side of the lake. And I was out there for quite some time picking up fishing lures and plugs and stuff. Well, I got on the other side of the lake, and I looked around for my pickup, and it wasn't there. And I'm thinking, oh, Christ, where is it? And I looked all the way across the other side of the lake, and it was over there. And so I had to walk all the way over to the other side of the lake to get it. Well, I was covered in mud, and there was a ranger waiting for me when I got over there and asked me if there was any problems or anything like that. And I said, no. And he looked down at me, and he said, I think there is a problem. He says, you don't have any pants on. And I lost my shoes, and I lost my pants, and he put me in his ranger vehicle and gave me a raincoat. Took me back to his ranger station and took the water hose out there and said, here, take care of yourself. But I washed myself off. Did I ever tell you this, Susan? Okay. More will be revealed. At any rate, he gave me a pair of shorts and I went on my merry way. But at any rate, March 15th of 1988, I didn't like me anymore. I was on my way to a little town called Tonyville outside of Lindsay. And I was going out there for something, and anyway, I didn't get it. But I pulled out, not someone, something, and I pulled my vehicle into this olive grove over there. And you know, there came a time when I didn't like me. I did not like what I had allowed my disease of alcoholism to happen. And so what happened, very briefly, was it was March 15th of 1988. I remember looking up there at those beautiful Sierra Mountains, and you could see the snow-capped peaks of Mineral King up there, and it was absolutely beautiful. And it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I can remember those clouds just having this beautiful golden glow around them. And I can remember getting down or getting out of my vehicle, and I took that jug of Karl Rossi Burgundy, and I'd been drinking vodka, too, during those years. And I had a pint or a half pint of vodka. And I can remember taking that wine and busting it up against the tree and just letting all that run down and everything. And I had some other substances in the car that I discarded. And I said, that's it, no more. You know, like our big book talks about, we swear off with and without a solemn oath. And bottom story short there, I got back in my vehicle and I started crying. And I said, you know what, how many times have I done that? And I didn't know until later that that's what our book says. You know, we swear off with, without, you know, with a solemn oath. So I got out of that vehicle, and I got down on my knees right there inside of that olive grove, and I said, God, I can't do this by myself. I need some help. I got back in my vehicle, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't see a burning bush or anything exciting like that. But what happened for me is I went back, and I stopped at Strathmore's, and there was a man that I knew was actively involved in the fellowship. And I went up and I knocked on his door and I said, I need some help. I want to talk to you about my drinking. And I thought he was going to make an appointment for me. But he said, how about right now? And he came out and he shared his experience, strengths, and hopes with me. And he told me, he said, there's a meeting up in Springville tomorrow night. He said, I can't be there, but if you'll be there, he said, I'll have someone meet you. 3 years before that occurrence, I was going to AA meetings 2 times a week for the judge. And I had no intentions of not drinking. And I'm out in the parking lot of this car, or out in the parking lot of this meeting, and I can remember having a beer in my right hand, and I was urinating in the parking lot with my left. And all of a sudden, this man comes up and he puts his hand on my shoulder. And I turned around and I start to swing at him. And he says, "You hit me, son, I'll hit you back." And he says, "You know, recovery works if you don't drink." And so I didn't go into that meeting. Fast forwarding to that Thursday night, that first meeting I went for me. I walked into that meeting up at Springville, and there were several people there. A couple of them came up and introduced themselves, which I think is very important to the newcomer to have someone do that. And that's what I try to do today, is every time I see a newcomer or someone that's new to the fellowship, I always introduce myself. So this man comes up to me, and I was drinking some V8 juice, and he came over and he sat down beside me, and he looked at me, and he says, "You know, son," he says, "recovery works if you don't drink." And that was that same man that 2 or 3 years ago I met in the parking lot. And he became my very first sponsor. And this ML was, well, Jim Luper already blew that one. Anyway, was at that meeting. And he says to me, "What are you doing on Sunday?" And I said, "Nothing that I know of. I don't have any plans." He says, "Yeah, you do." He says, "We have this speaker's breakfast." And it was down at the old DFW hall. And he told me what time he wanted me there. So I was there at 4 o'clock in the morning, setting up tables. Nobody else was there, just me and him. And he sat there and drank coffee, and he started talking to me. And he started talking about this thing called getting into service. And he started saying, "This is what worked for me and countless others." And he started talking about how part of what works for so many people is to give of yourself in recovery. And that man was the very first person that taught me about service. And he says to me, he says, "I got a job for you. We're having a service fair at the Episcopal Church in Porterville." And he says, "And you are going to be the food chair." And I was the food chair. And you know, he told me what to do, and I did it. And when that activity occurred, that food chair activity occurred, I was standing in the back of the room back there, and the secretary of the meeting started saying, "And we would like to thank so-and-so for, you know, doing this, and we'd like to thank so-and-so for doing this," and I'm standing back there by Janet. And they said, "I'd like to thank," and he started talking about the food and how wonderful it was, and I just kind of went, you know, like this. And he said, "Well, our food chair doesn't want to be thanked, and we thank him anyway." And that night, Jim says, "You know," he says, "that's what it's all about." He says, "We just give of ourselves, and we don't need to be thanked." And so that's always been hard for me to have someone thank me, but I appreciate it. And that's okay, too, I guess, you know, but I've always been a little bit shy about that. But at any rate, that's how it all started in recovery for me. People started saying, started talking about the steps. And they started talking about service, and they started talking about commitments. And, you know, for me, it was right at the very beginning, it was getting involved with you people. It was getting your phone numbers and giving you my phone numbers. It was about not only getting your phone number, but calling you when I had those phone numbers. Because I can have a whole list of phone numbers but not do anything about it. And then I started working the steps with my sponsor. And the way it worked for me is I started working the steps, and sometimes, from my experience, I'm not going to say my opinion, I'm just going to say my experience. From my experience, this is what happened for me. Sometimes I grow differently in the program from the people around me. Sometimes I need to start socializing and fellowshipping with people who are getting more vested in their recovery, and that's what worked for me. I oftentimes hear these things about sticking with the winners, you know. I think we're all winners. I think it just takes some of us a little bit longer to get started, you know. And the thing of it is I don't know how it works for anybody else, but as I said, I think, you know, I grew differently in different areas of my recovery. I continue to learn, I continue to grow, and I continue to make mistakes. Not only in my recovery aspect of what I'm doing with my 12 steps, but in my life, I make bad judgments sometimes. I have consequences in recovery sometimes because of the actions that I've done. They may be financial consequences. They may be spiritual consequences. Anna Rigmer talks about progress, not perfection. And it is so wonderful for me to go to a lot of meetings and to stay in those meetings. To not go out, I'm just speaking for me, to not go out and smoke cigarettes and bullshit, you know, or I shouldn't have probably said that, but I did anyway. To not go out and what will you think of me if I cuss, you know? But, you know, for me, it's all about staying in the meeting and listening to the message. I never know who I'm going to hear what from. You know, I learn as much from the newcomers as I do from the old-timers, the people that have been around a lot longer than I have. And there's a Native American saying that I especially love, and it says, we don't know what we don't know until we know it. And I'm not going to know it if I don't participate in my recovery. And Jim taught me the stick-to-itiveness. It's like, if I have a disagreement or a misunderstanding with a fellow AA member, and I can do that today constructively. I don't always do it constructively. Thank you, David. Anyway, if I have a disagreement, I learn from that. And the next time I might just do it, you know, find a solution, you know, just a little bit differently, go about a situation, you know, a little bit differently. But what I found in this fellowship is I've got a lot of principles, a lot of character in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have. You know, I would just ask each and every one of you to think of the worst situation that you put yourself in behind your drinking. I want you to just think just for a moment about the worst situation that you put yourself in behind your drinking. And if you got that imprinted in your head, from my experience, from working through these steps, we can learn how not to put ourselves in that situation again or a similar situation. I don't have to experience the pain, the guilt, all of those things that I felt when I first came in. Because, you know, when I first came in, I think I said to myself, it'll always be this way. I'll always feel this horrible. But, you know, if I just keep coming back, if I just keep participating, I keep participating in my recovery. And I think the thing that I learned that is so important to me is when it comes to sponsorship, is that the solutions to my problems are only going to get better with the guidance of my sponsor and people who I am close to in the fellowship, if I'm honest. If I sit here and I bullshit you and I bullshit my sponsor and I bullshit everybody else, I'm not going to have any real solutions. And that's one thing that I learned the hard way. And you know, sometimes I found it necessary for me to grow differently with sponsorship recently. And you know, my previous sponsor did the best he could with what he had, and I will forever be grateful about that. But sometimes we just grow differently. And I think it's an okay thing, you know. And it's like with my first marriage, I was married for 25 years to my first wife. And it was just what I knew. When I got married to, I'm going to say it like this, when God put the special lady in my life that I have today, when he put her in my life, I did not know what happiness was until I have experienced these past 13 years of marriage. And so sometimes I don't know what's best for me until it happens. You know, And I am so grateful for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can call my sponsor, and the thing of it is I can look out across this room, and there are 12, 13 people in my life today that I could call just in this room any time, night or day. And I feel in my heart that those people would be there for me in one way or other. If they couldn't be there physically, they would be there for me in prayer. They would be there for me in person. They would be there for me. And that's what I found that the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, does for me. And, I do want to say this one little thing because I don't have a whole lot of time here. I'm one of those persons that I love Alcoholics Anonymous so much that before I get up here and speak, I just say, God, whatever you want me to say, just put it in my heart and let it come out my mouth. And that seems to work best for me. But in my wallet, I've got a little card that I carry in my wallet. And I was only 3 months sober. And we had a family tragedy back in Missouri, and I had to go back to Missouri. And on the way back, I was afraid. And Jim told me that when I got back there, he says, you make sure that you call central office or you find out where those meetings are. As soon as I got back to Missouri, I called. That's where I went 3 months after I was sober. And when I got back there, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was very, very sick when I went back there. I had a lung infection, and it's really amazing that sometimes, I know this from experience from some of the people that I sponsor, that when we get into recovery, a lot of times people get sick because they've used the alcohol to camouflage or kill the pain that they had, and then reality sets in. So when I went to that meeting, or went back there to Missouri, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and within 2 hours, there were two men who came to my brother's house, and they were elderly men, kind of like me. They came upstairs. My brother brought them upstairs, and they brought the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they sat there just like they did, back in the 40s, And they sat there beside me, and they fellowshiped for three. Well, I almost choked up on that one. They fellowshiped three different times, three different days, until I was well enough for them to come and take me to a meeting. One of the old-timers gave me this card, and I carry it in my wallet to this day. And this card just says, welcome, my friend, and a friend you must be. For letting me help you also helps me. And it says, if you have a problem, you're not alone. All you have to do is just pick up the phone. And that man put his name on here. And his name was Steve Lee. And I called that man two or three times a year for many years until he passed away. And when I went back to Missouri about 3 or 4 years ago, I was at a meeting, and I noticed that they had a picture of this man in their 12-step club. And his wife was still alive, and she is an active member of Al-Anon. I would just like to thank all of you for being here. There's so much I could say, but bottom line is, for me, I have a problem, or had a problem, however I want to look at it, with alcohol. I understand about unmanageability of my life. The wonderful thing today is my chances are very slim that my great-grandson is never going to want to see me again. Chances are very slim that my wife is going to put my suitcase out on the front porch. Chances are very slim that my boss is going to give me a pink slip. My chances are none that my sponsor is going to fire me, because I'm doing some things right today, and that's only because of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the grace of God, and all of you people in these rooms. Thank you for letting me share.